Remember the good old days before Microsoft Word had autosave? You'd type up some important document and then your computer would freeze and you'd lose hours of work just because you forgot to hit save? Well, that's what it's like going online without ExpressVPN. Every time you're connected to an unencrypted network, whether it's in an airport, a hotel, a cafe, or anywhere, your online data is not secure. Any person on that same network who knows what they're doing can gain access to your personal data. Bank logins, credit card details, passwords, all the stuff you don't want people seeing. Unfortunately, hacking has become much easier than it used to be. People don't even have to be exceptionally skilled to do it, and there's a lot of money to be made by selling your information on the dark web. ExpressVPN stops hackers from stealing your data by creating a secure, encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet. It's incredibly easy to use. Once the app is running, you literally click one button to get protected. And it works on your phone, laptop, tablet, and more, so you can stay protected on the go. I've been using ExpressVPN for a little while now, and I can rest easy knowing my info is safe and secure. I've heard horror stories of people who've been hacked, and it sounds like a massive pain to try to get any resolution in the aftermath, so I am not interested in finding out what that process is like. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/film. That's expressvpn.com/film. And you can get an extra 3 months free. expressvpn.com/film. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Wednesday, July 3rd, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about Beverly Hills Cop Axel F., and we're also going to rank the entire franchise and present an interview with Axel F. director Mark Molloy. My name is Ben Pearson. I am an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
Brad, today is the day that Beverly Hills Cop Axel F., the fourth film in this franchise, has arrived on Netflix. As of right now, people can go and watch this movie if they choose. You and I have seen this film. Obviously, I talked to the director. We'll present that interview in just a little bit. But I guess before we get into our thoughts about Axel F., what is your relationship to this franchise as a whole?
It actually kind of evolved more again recently because I had seen the original Beverly Hills Cop when I was in college, I think, for the first time. And I've seen the first one a few times since then. Only recently did I realize that I never got around to watching two in its entirety. I had seen some pretty like big chunks of it, but I guess I never sat down to watch the whole thing. And then I never watched three because I heard that it was very bad. But I recently did like a rewatch of the entire series, and so caught up with all of that. So yeah, that's pretty much where I stand.
Okay, so we'll get into our ranking after the break and in the back half of the show. But were you looking forward to this, or were you kind of dreading this movie?
I was more, I think, curious than anything because it's been so long since they've done a Beverly Hills Cop movie. Eddie Murphy's comedy chops haven't been as strong in recent years. And I was curious what this kind of franchise would look like in, you know, to today's contemporary, you know, cinematic landscape. So, I thought the trailer looked decent. It seemed like they were hitting all the right points. It felt just like a Beverly Hills Cop movie should. So I was interested in checking it out and hopeful that it was going to turn out to be good.
Okay, so let's get into some spoiler-free thoughts. With that as the preamble, what did you make of the actual movie itself?
I think it's pretty decent. I don't think it's comes close to hitting the highs of the original franchise. It's nowhere near as bad as the worst entry in the franchise, which I won't give away here, even though you could probably guess what it is if you've been following the franchise for a long time. But yeah, I think it's very enjoyable. I wish it was a little bit funnier. More and more these days, I'm noticing that especially action comedies, they're really lacking in like bringing in really good jokes and like laugh out loud stuff. Like even with Bad Boys Ride or Die was the most recent example where it just feels like maybe, I don't know if they're not bringing in comedians anymore to do punch ups on scripts. If they're just relying on they're like, oh yeah, Will Smith and Martin Lawrence and Eddie Murphy, they can handle the jokes. And it's just like, no man, like you need to get people who are like a professional comedian to come in and like help write some of this stuff because there's stuff that just falls flat. You know, there's parts where like you could easily get jokes in there and they didn't. And I wish that there was a little more comedy here. But for the most part, I thought it was, you know, fine.
Yeah, I also think this movie is fine. It's much, much better than I thought it was going to be. So it has that going for it. I think, especially for like effectively a July 4th release, where a lot of people are probably going to be home and have the day off tomorrow. Like, just, I imagine people kicking back and throwing this on. It's going to be a really enjoyable experience for a lot of people, especially people who have like fond memories of the first two movies and maybe haven't really thought about this franchise very much since then. I totally agree with what you're saying about the comedy stuff. Like, it's rough out there for comedies these days. Like, I know that, you know, we've been talking about how there aren't really many theatrical comedies kind of period in existence, right? You know, being made anymore these days, but like the stuff that does come through that is clearly supposed to be funny. I don't know, man. I don't know if it's like we're getting older and so this stuff doesn't hit for us in the same way, but I feel like there's an underlying thing going on, which is what you're talking about. Like, the craft of comedy is being lost in the process of this a little bit. So I don't know if there's anybody out here listening who can actually have an impact on that in a project moving forward. Like, try as much as humanly possible within your budget to go the extra mile to get the jokes where they need to be, because that's one of those things that can really, really elevate a project. But like you said, just kind of falls flat a lot in not just this movie, but in a lot of movies going forward, or, you know, like in our modern landscape these days. So what else did you want to, I guess, mention about this movie before we get into some spoilery stuff?
If there's one thing that I think succeeds like in a really big way that I loved, it was the score for this movie. Lauren Balfe, man, he crushed it. Like, he captured the feeling of like that 1980s synth that everybody loves, but he also contemporized it and made it feel cool and modern. Did some really cool riffs on the theme. Did some really cool synth riffs on the songs that the franchise is famous for, other than the Axel Foley theme, which I really enjoyed. That was awesome. Like, I would love to just like sit and have this soundtrack on while I'm driving or working or something like that, because it's really, really catchy, and he did a phenomenal job with it.
Yeah, they definitely got the music right. We'll talk about how the music maybe evolves over the course of the franchise in our ranking a little bit later. But yeah, I thought this was like a nice return to form on that front. I also thought Eddie Murphy was pretty great in this movie. Like, he feels like he still has a handle on this character and has brought him into the modern world while still retaining some of what we love about Axel. That's a kind of a tricky thing to pull off without falling back too many times on like the same exact lines and jokes and things that we've seen before. So what did you think about how Eddie acquitted himself in this movie?
Yeah, I thought he was solid in this. I feel like he's been pretty good for the most part in recent years when it comes to stuff like Dolomite Is My Name and the sequel to Coming to America, which I enjoyed for the most part as well. It's kind of on par with this, where it's like, it's not nearly as good as the original, but it's fine. It's enjoyable. I think he's finally reached a point where like he realizes like he doesn't need to do the big over the top stuff anymore. And Beverly Hills Cop was always a franchise where he wasn't ever really like being crazy with his comedy. You know, he has moments where like if he gets into character where he has like little outbursts, but he wasn't being ridiculous or zany or anything like that. And I think that the emotional core of this movie also helps to like ground him. It gives him something that he really has to like learn from, because he doesn't really have much of a character arc in the original franchise. You know, he's kind of doing his thing and like everyone else kind of just has to deal with his bullshit. But here he actually has to like change as a character and realize, you know, that some stuff has changed.
Yeah, in the first movie, he loses one of his best friends. Like, one of his best friends is murdered right next to him. And so, ostensibly, the whole film is like a revenge movie. He's like out for justice for his fallen friend. But like, the movie has such a light touch and like such a great balance of comedy and action that you kind of at times almost forget why he's even in Beverly Hills in the first place. Yeah. And this movie, yeah, and even I think the second film, like, Bogomil goes missing or is shot or something, like injured or whatever. So like, he's kind of like, he's had this thing lit under him that like a catalyst that drives him forward in these stories. And this time that's not there. And it's replaced by that emotional core you're talking about. So I want to talk about that a little bit more. Let's get into some spoiler stuff. So if you've not caught up with the movie, just go ahead and pause it. I'm giving people just a couple more seconds to pause it before we, okay. All right. So yeah, what did you make of like the Taylor Page character who plays Axel's daughter and that whole dynamic between those two characters and sort of what it does for Axel to exist as, you know, as a 2024 character instead of a 1980s character, basically?
Yeah, I think she brings a great dynamic to the table. I kind of wish that there was a little bit of this like history established in previous installments. That's obviously kind of hard because, you know, it's been so long since we've had a Beverly Hills Cop movie. So it's not knowing about that kind of makes sense. But like, it's one thing that has always like bugged me about certain sequels and stuff like that, when they introduce new characters and like there's this implied history between them and stuff that you kind of just have to learn as you go along. But even so, you know, I think that the dynamic that is established between them is good, and the way that he has to evolve as a character also works alongside his daughter. It creates a, you know, a unique opportunity for the character to actually show some growth. His daughter is great in this movie too. It's clear that she's like, you know, inherited some of his, you know, sneaky ways, but she has a little bit more of like a different compass for her character. I really liked that evolution of that part of this movie.
What did you think about Joseph Gordon-Levitt?
He's great too. You know, I honestly wish that there was a little more of like interaction with them as characters, because they have a really great, you know, banter and chemistry back and forth. And I would have liked to have seen, you know, one of the big action sequences in the middle of the movie is probably the height of it. And I think I would have liked more if they were a force to be together for a little bit longer in the movie.
Do you mean Taylor Page and Joseph Gordon-Levitt, or Eddie and Joseph Gordon-Levitt?
Oh, Eddie and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I mean, Taylor Page and Joseph Gordon-Levitt, you know, are it's fine. It's whatever. That part, I actually think that there could have been a little more meat and substance to that, other than like, oh, they used to date and there's this kind of weird dynamic. It never really feel like they fully like resolve that in a way, you know, because like they have that kiss in the house, and then like it kind of doesn't fully complete. But yes, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, I would have loved to have seen more with him and Eddie Murphy. They had a really good back and forth.
Yeah, I read an interview with Mark Molloy when I was doing research for my interview with him, and he mentioned that like they're working on a script for another movie already, and like he might come back and direct that. So I guess that could be an opportunity to get these characters back together and continue that story that way. But yeah, I did feel that like I wish there would have been maybe a cleaner button put on that relationship as we went forward.
Similarly, actually, because like that served as like a replacement for the fact that Axel doesn't really get much time to interact with Taggart or Billy, because Billy's kidnapped and Taggart's the chief, so he's not like as involved in the usual antics with Axel that he usually is. And I think that they realized that they were missing that throughout most of the movie, which is why they have that little tag at the end of the movie where Axel hops in the car with Taggart and Billy. And that made me realize, I was like, oh shit, yeah, we didn't really get a lot of this. And I wish they could have like reconfigured the story somehow so that Billy was hanging out with Axel again, you know, like,
yeah,
it's, I'm surprised that they went that route when they easily could have done something that like tapped even more into to what worked about the original franchise.
Yeah. I don't know how much they wanted to rely on Judge Reinhold and John Ashton as actors at this stage in their career. You know, it kind of had that sense of like, let's get them in there so the fans of the original, you know, have something to grab onto. And so Eddie, you know, has that relationship to play on, but like, let's kind of kick them to the side for like the real action stuff, you know, get somebody, Joseph Gordon-Levitt flying in a helicopter instead of Billy Rosewood or whatever. But
yeah,
I have to talk to you about them too, because like, I realize this might sound nitpicky and annoying, and I apologize in advance, but like, to me, the fact that Taggart and Rosewood experienced this rift in their relationship because Taggart didn't support Rosewood doesn't really make sense to me. Like, yes, we haven't seen these characters together on screen since whatever, 1987, and people can change. So maybe that's what the screenwriters are kind of trying to get at here. But like, I feel like their bond was so strong in those early movies. And Billy has proven himself time and again to be a good, largely competent police officer. So for Taggart to like write him off as a nut job after presumably spending decades worth of cases and stuff with him just didn't really strike me as like a strong storytelling choice. I don't know. Did that bother you? Or
yeah, a little bit, because like it's another one of those things that comes with like filling in the gaps between the previous movies and this one. Like, so much has happened, but in this case it works against that development, because you would think that after working together for so long, like, why wouldn't you trust? It's the same problem that I have with Ghostbusters Afterlife, like, where I don't like the idea that the rest of the Ghostbusters don't believe Egon when he says there's something big on the horizon. It's like, why wouldn't you trust Egon? Like, how is this creating a rift in your friendship, you know? And so that does seem a little odd. I guess, like, if there's one maybe way that, like, explains it, it's that, like, at least in those first two movies, like, Taggart is still pretty, like, resistant to, like, going outside of, you know, the rules of engagement, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. I forget. There's a phrase that I'm thinking
of. The chain of command.
Chain of command. There we go. And he, even in those movies, like, he's reluctant, like, even if it works out. And so, like, I can see him still kind of being, like, a by-the-book person, especially when he becomes chief of police and stuff like that, especially with everyone he has to answer to. But, again, you have all that time that has passed since the previous movies where, like, they've probably worked together. And so it would seem weird that he'd just be like, no, man, like, he's off his rocker.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of bringing somebody back, I just didn't think the Serge stuff worked at all in this movie. I just thought it was like a disaster. I don't know. Like, you're more attuned to comedy stuff, and I think you're more forgiving on that front. What would you make of that?
I think Bronson Pinchot is great in the role. My biggest problem with it is that it doesn't make any sense to, like, put him in this movie. It's it makes a little more sense than his role did in Beverly Hills Cop 3, but, like, it definitely feels forced. I still thought he was funny, and the way that they interacted, like, that dynamic was still there, and that was enjoyable. But yeah, from a writing standpoint, it was just like I have no idea, like, how you thought this was the best way to fit him in here.
Yeah, I just think this is an example of, like, the worst case scenario for legacy sequels like this, where, like, you know, he's basically back just to have the same interaction that he had with Axel in the first movie, where Axel's like, get the fuck out of here. And he's like, no, I cannot. Like, they
repeated
that twice in this movie alone. And it's just like, guys, come on, you gotta move past this. Like, I know it feels so desperate. Like, they're just trying to recapture the magic that happened as, like, an improv thing in the first movie that was not scripted and just, like, was this organic moment. And it just feels so, like, desperation is a stinky cologne.
But I did like that sequence, because Nassim Pedrad is also really funny in that scene. I like her a lot. And so, like, it was still a funny scene. It's definitely not Bronson Pinchot's fault that it didn't really work out though. I honestly, like, I don't know why they just didn't, like, make it that, like, he's still an acquaintance of, like, his daughter or something, you know, like, he was probably around and maybe, you know, could have been introduced to her and been kind of like a weird uncle kind of situation,
yeah,
maybe,
like,
you know,
something like that, some sort of assistant type of figure. Yeah. Anything like that. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's take a break and then we'll come back and rank these movies and then present the interview. All right. So I want to ask you, Brad, having watched Beverly Hills Cop 3 for the first time recently, what'd you think of it?
Oh gosh. I mean, I knew that it was not good, but it is so much worse than I anticipated. Like, it's lifeless. It looks cheap. The story doesn't make sense. The villain is terrible. Eddie Murphy's clearly phoning it in. It's even edited poorly. Like, the cuts from, like, action sequences to set pieces where they clearly had to, like, set up a car that's on fire or something like that after previously wrecking it. Like, it feels like it's cut just a little bit wonky so that, like, it doesn't feel like there's any motion in the action between frames.
Yeah.
And, like, even the way it's scored is bad. Like, the music that plays during the sequence when he's rescuing the kids off of that theme park ride, and the way it's cut, it's like, what the fuck's going on? who did this?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was really, really bad.
Yeah, I rewatched it for the first time since my childhood to prepare for this. And, like, good God, I cannot think of a precipitous drop in quality that is as dramatic as Beverly Hills Cop 2 to Beverly Hills Cop 3. It is like, I mean, I guess when all of the movies are theatrical, you know, sometimes when you're talking about, like, whatever, the Caddyshack sequels that might have gone straight to DVD, or, like, the American Pie sequels, or, you know, those types of, like, National Lampoon's movies that went straight to video or whatever, like,
yeah,
I'm sure there's going to be a big drop in quality. But, like, for a major franchise to have an entry that is that terrible, terrible. I think it's pretty clear that that's the worst movie, right? Like, can we jointly agree
there? Oh, yeah. 100%. It is easily the worst movie in the franchise. Like, not even not even close.
God, and the music, like you were saying, it's so terrible. Like, they don't even, they screw up Axel F. Like, they did this sort of remix of it the whole movie, and it just does not have the same swagger and energy and intensity and, like, playful sense of fun that the real music does. And it just feels like this hollow echo of itself. It's awful. And then also,
I will say I don't mind the orchestral version of the theme occasionally, but, like, the fact that they didn't rely more on the synth version is insane.
Yeah, totally. I also just wanted to underline what you're saying about, like, the movie kind of looking bad, like the editing is terrible, but also, like, John Landis directed this third film, and he's directed some good stuff over the course of his career. It seems like he should know what he's doing by the time it comes to, you know, early 90s when he starts making this movie. And there are, like, single shots of characters having conversations where, like, people are framed weird and, like, why would you shoot it this way? Like, just back out and show a two shot or something here. Like, and I never think about that stuff really. Like, when I'm watching a movie, I never really criticize the choices, like, while they're happening, unless something is super egregious. But I was, like, so thrown by the choices that were made in terms of, like, the technical craft of this movie that I was just like, you know, the story is terrible, yes, but, like, also this movie just looks and feels like utter trash. So,
yeah,
I don't know. It was really rough.
And, like, and all the other versions of what this movie could have been sound way more interesting. Like, there was an early draft that had Foley and Rosewood and Taggart going to London to rescue Bogomil, who's, like, being held hostage by terrorists during an international police convention.
Okay.
There was one that feels, it's, like, skews a little closer to what this movie is, but with a little more interesting dynamic, where the character that Teresa Randall plays in this movie, who's a theme park worker who inexplicably sparks a romance with Axel for no good reason whatsoever. It seems like that character was maybe originally intended to be his niece, and the movie would have been more of a Die Hard riff at the theme park with Axel and his niece working together. There was another one that came from Robert Town, which would have teamed Eddie Murphy with Sean Connery as a Scotland Yard detective.
Whoa.
Yeah. And then another version of that would have had him teamed up with John Cleese, which, again, would have also been really fun. But yeah, none of them ever came to fruition. And the one that was the Die Hard in a theme park one came from Stephen E. D'Souza, and that one never went forward either. And, like, but it seems like some remnants were kind of kept in Beverly Hills Cop 3, and thanks to the ridiculous and terrible theme park angle it has.
Yeah. Okay, so that's number four. I would personally say that Axel F goes in the number three slot, but what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with that too, because it's not quite as good as one or two, but it stands on its own ground. It's entertaining enough. It's decent. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think there's some good stuff in here. I may have sounded a little harsher on the movie than I actually was. Like, I enjoyed watching it. I just think there's room for improvement. There are ways that this movie could have been better. Like, I really liked the practical helicopter stuff at the end of this movie. You can actually tell that they're shooting it with a real helicopter, and, like, you know, you can fake a CG helicopter flying through the streets, but you can't convincingly fake, you know, all the blades of grass being blown down by the
exactly,
and stuff like that. You know, like, that you can actually tell that they really did this, and you get that sense that this is, like, a visceral thing. Like, this is a real object in space here. So I really appreciated that.
Yeah. And also, it feels like a direct slap in the face to John Landis.
Yeah. Jesus Christ.
Who doesn't work well with helicopters. Ooh.
Yeah, you can look that up if you don't know the truth behind that story. Okay, so yeah, we've got the final two here. So now it's just a matter of whether we put the first movie first or the second movie first. And let's talk about the second movie for a second, because Tony Scott directed that. There's so much style in Beverly Hills Cop 2. Like, did you rewatch that one leading up to this as well?
So I said in the opening, I actually hadn't seen that one in its entirety. So yeah, so I did watch it, and it was basically the first time I watched the entire movie. So yeah.
Okay, that's right. So yeah, like, you know, when Bogomil is running in the opening scene and everything is just bathed in orange, it is so, like, pure Tony Scott 80s, hyper stylized, like, full on Top Gun level, you know, imagery, visuals and stuff. So I love that, because it's totally different than what the first movie looks like. The first movie looks pretty standard. Like there's not really a bunch of what I would call like directorial flair or whatever in that first film. It's just like a sturdy story that works on its own and doesn't really rely on style to get it by. But the Tony Scott movie is like so stylish, and it's also like pretty dark compared to the first film. Like it's kind of a nastier movie in some ways. And like what happens to Billy Rosewood in the second movie, where he basically like goes off the deep end and becomes like a gun nut, and he's like obsessed with weaponry, and like he's got a Cobra poster on his wall, which is funny because the first movie was basically meant to be a Sylvester Stallone movie that ended up he walked away from that movie and made Cobra, which is like what his vision for what Beverly Hills Cop should have been. And so the fact that Billy Rosewood is like a fan of that movie is just funny. So I don't know. There's like some really good stuff in that film. But for me, I think it's a little bit under the first movie. But what do you think about it?
Yeah, I think I'm pretty much in the same route, because Tony Scott does bring a lot more visual style to the movie, and the action feels like it has more weight and it's a bit more serious. I also think the second one falls a little bit short because it doesn't feel like it has any set pieces that are as big as the first one. And the first one starts off with an awesome car chase with some great practical crashes, like when you have that truck barreling through like a suburban neighborhood and just smashing through cars, real explosions and stuff. Like it's a really good big sequence. And then there's some like some shootouts later, and I don't feel like there is ever really a sequence that is as big as that opening, which is a little bit to the detriment of the first movie. But the second one I don't feel like really has a big action set piece like that to like really be like the star or the focal point. I think that that's where it kind of like falls a little bit.
Yeah. There's the, I guess the shootout at the end of the warehouse or whatever, but like that kind of feels like it could have gone in any 80s movie, like a generic action movie. So, So, all right. Well, I think it sounds like we're in agreement then. So the first movie should probably be number one then, right? Like that's the only thing we have left. So I think, I don't know, for me, the first film is like the perfect action comedy. I know it's like one of the forebears of the entire genre. I think technically like 48 Hours beat it to the punch, another Eddie Murphy movie that you could call technically like a buddy cop type of film. But like in terms of action comedies, for me, it doesn't really get much better than the first Beverly Hills Cop. It's so good. The comedy is like on point all throughout. The action is really good. And it's also like a real detective story too. Like you've got a real thing there, a real skeleton for them to like hang this story on that feels like Axel Foley is actually good at his job. Like he's a good detective going through the motions of trying to solve his friend's murder. And like, there's a practicality and like a step-by-step and like a process, kind of a process-oriented approach to telling that story that I think really works for that film. But what do you think about the first movie?
No, I agree 100%. It's got like a great mix of Eddie Murphy's brand of comedy, letting him do his thing, but also not forgetting that like, oh, this is still an action movie and like and a crime movie. And it doesn't like sacrifice any of that for Eddie Murphy's comedy. All the stuff where like Eddie Murphy gets to like, you know, run off at the mouth and be hilarious and a smart ass. Like it all makes sense within the context of the story. There's nothing that is just like, okay, we'll let Eddie Murphy do his thing, no matter how little sense it makes. You know, it's really grounded. And yeah, it works. It's something that like, I think some action comedies that are meant to be more grounded in reality kind of forget. And this one, yeah, the Beverly Hills Cop has always done it really well.
Is there a favorite Axel Foley moment across all of these movies for you? Is there one thing that sticks in your head as being like either representative of the character or just like tickles you in the right way?
I've always loved the scene in the original where he pretends to be a reporter from Rolling Stone to get a hotel room. The article is going to be called Michael Jackson Takes on the World, but now it's going to be called Michael Jackson Takes on the World unless you're trying to get a hotel room at Beverly Hills Hotel. But yeah, like that's I love that. And one of the things I really liked in the second one, too, and like it's something that you don't really see an evolution of very often in action comedies like that. Maybe 22 Jump Street is the only one that really like has some fun with it, but like in a more meta way. But I like that this time when he's in Beverly Hills in the second one, his way of staying somewhere is to just basically squat in a mansion that's under construction. Yes. And that scene's hilarious, too.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things about Axel Foley. That's, I say this in the interview with Mark Molloy in a second, but that's like, I think Axel's superpower is that he has this ability to read people instantly and know exactly what he needs to say and do to like get what he wants out of them. Yeah. And the moments across all of these movies, and he does it in the fourth film too, when he, yeah, like adopts a character or like gets into this, you know, he sort of like just barges into places and he's like slapping clipboards around and like just kind of like bullying people into thinking that you know, they need to do his bidding or whatever. And it's just so entertaining. There's just like, there's something aspirational about that. Like, none of us would have the balls to ever try anything like that in real life. So it's just so funny to see Eddie Murphy do it and like do it in such a funny way and actually get away with it too. So I love that part of the character.
And actually, Jeremy Smith wrote a really good article about how this kind of evolves in the fourth movie. And it's something that I really appreciate and didn't fully absorb with the first time that I watched it, is that because you do get to see Axel doing that same shtick when he kind of like confuses a couple henchmen who are digging through Billy's private eye office and everything. Mm-hmm. And he pretends that he's supposed to be there and was sent by their boss. But then later, when he tries to do similar things by trying to get into like an exclusive club at the Eastern, or trying to like kind of get under the skin of Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character, those tricks don't always work for him. And so like, it's a cool way of showing, it's like, oh, okay. So like, yeah, Axel's still good at what he does, but like, his tricks haven't necessarily like fully evolved with the times. And so like, he gets help from his daughter, and like he gets pushback from someone who's like, no, I'm not going to fall for your bullshit, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely like, I want to give the new movie credit for not leaning as much as it could on the nostalgia stuff. Like, that's a great
example. I will say there's one thing that I'm a little torn on, because it's amusing, but it also felt a little lazy to me. And I'm not sure where I land. I'm curious to see what you think. But there's a scene when they could have easily done the hotel bit again, because he goes to the same Beverly Hills hotel and he starts to do a bit where he says he's, you know, Nigel somebody from Bon Appetit, and then he's like, no, you know what? I'm too tired for this shit. Like, do you have any vacancies? And I was just like, okay, that's fine. But it's also like, oh, maybe you just also didn't want to try to write a funny bit for this moment.
Yeah, I don't know. That seemed like a callback for the people who have not paid attention to these movies really closely or in a long time. It seemed like, you know, for the folks who remembered, it seemed like one of those Easter eggs that like kind of works but kind of doesn't, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's just kind of like, I feel like there may have been a way. It's kind of like, I guess it could be perceived as like a nod to Indiana Jones just shooting the sword guy in Raiders of the Lost Ark. Like,
yeah,
we don't need to go through this whole song and dance, but like, when that's an inherent part of the character and you're kind of lampshading that and calling attention to it, for them to like then back away from it and say, like, within the context of the movie, for Axel to acknowledge, hey, I don't really do this anymore, and then for him to actually try to do it several other times in the movie, I don't know, it strikes a weird tone, I think.
Yeah, but like, I almost would have preferred it if like he did try to go through it, but because like everything is so easily accessible as far as information, like the woman goes to look him up and like, oh, is this you? And it's just like some stuffy British white guy, and it's just foiled.
Yeah. Taking it a little further than they actually took it. Yeah, that, and then he could give up. And
yeah, exactly.
Because then it would tell us something about Axel's place in the world, and like how he, maybe those bits don't really work in 2024 as well as they did in the 80s or whatever. But this is just kind of like, I don't know, it tells us that Axel's tired, I guess, which is like not that interesting. But all right. Well, I guess with all of that said, here is my interview with Beverly Hills Cop Axel F director Mark Molloy. This is your first feature film, but you've been directing commercials and things like that for well over 20 years at this point, I think. So when you first got the call from Jerry Bruckheimer saying that he wanted to work with you, did he mention if there was one specific commercial or piece of work that he saw that put you on his radar?
He didn't mention anything on the first call that we did. He didn't mention anything specific. But then since then, he's told me that there was a bunch of work, a lot of the Apple work I've done, and so I did like a sort of series of kind of like short films for Apple. He'd seen those amongst other things. And yeah, and so I think that was, I don't know what got Jerry. I don't know what was the final bit, but I'm glad my work caught his eye. Yeah.
I was curious if you had to get special approval from Eddie Murphy, or was Jerry's sort of sign off enough to convince everybody that you were the guy for this project?
No, I had to get Eddie's approval too. I had to get Eddie's approval, I had to get Netflix's approval, I had to get everyone's approval, you know. So it was quite a journey. But sort of me and Jerry went to Eddie's house, and I just kind of pitched him my take on the film. And luckily Eddie agreed and liked it, and here we are.
What was he most concerned about when it came to reprising this role all these years later?
First thing he told me, it's the most important character he's ever played. So he held it really, you know, it meant a lot to him, and I could really feel that. I think like the main thing he really wanted to make sure was I understood the tone of the films and the balance of action and comedy. I know was really important to him, and also, you know, I talked to him a lot about how this we get to see a different side to his character, you know, the evolution of character and Axel as a father and Axel being vulnerable. I spoke to him a lot. I said we've never seen Axel probably vulnerable, and that really excited me. And just sort of we talked through that, and and Eddie really wanted to get a sense, but Eddie had such a keen sense of the character in his head too. He had a really, you know, like of not just who Axel Foley used to be, but that evolution of character.
It was like a something of a creative risk for him to come back after all these years, because I think even with the third movie, which is not widely accepted as being a great entry or whatever, this franchise is still like very highly thought of in the community or whatever, the filmmaking, film loving community. I wonder what kind of conversations did you guys have on set? Like you told me about what he was thinking going into it, but actually like on the ground while you guys were making stuff, what kind of conversations were the two of you having about making sure that you struck that right balance to get Axel the way that he needed to be?
We spoke a lot about just different scenes and where, you know, where to skew scenes comedic or where the comedy fits in, and where we wanted to be more grounded and more emotional and just let the action speak, or where we want to set up for the emotion too. So we talked a lot about just the rise and fall of the comedy and the drama and the action, like all three of those things on set. We're talking about that a lot.
To me, Axel Foley's superpower has always been his ability to read people and like instantly know what he needs to do and say to get what he wants out of a given situation. And that happens a few times in this movie. I was curious if that aspect of the character was present in the first draft of the script that you read, or if that was added in later on when Eddie came, like officially signed on, or like how did that work?
No, it was a bit, some stuff was there from the very start. Other stuff we were sort of working on as even as we were shooting, we were still working on some of the scenes, you know, and getting Eddie's sort of opinion on it and sort of reshaping them. But it's funny that you say that thing about Axel Foley's superpower. That's what really excited me about the script too, is like Axel Foley has all that power to do that. But then what I loved about the script too is then he gets to meet his daughter, where none of his powers are, they're all useless against her. She's seen it all, lived it all. And so he's kind of, she's his kryptonite a little bit. So I think that was really fun to play with.
There's that great moment when the two of them go into that mode together and they like try to talk their way into that building, into that rooftop party or whatever. So that was really fun to see as well. I was wondering when it came down to, after the pitch was over and after you got the job and everything, when it came down to actually making this movie, what were you excited to bring to it as a director? Was there something specific that you really thought you could bring to this?
I think like one of the biggest things I really wanted to bring to it was to you know, I really looked at those at the tone of the first two films, and I wanted to get that same tone right. You know, I wanted to get the same tone right, where there's the balance between action and comedy, get that balance between action and comedy, and also to ground the film. Like what I think about those two films is they were very grounded, those two films. Obviously they're big comedy, huge set action pieces, but the films are grounded in character. And so I really worked hard on that, on grounding the film, but also grounding the action too. Shooting everything in camera, just pulling everything back a little bit, building action scenes around character rather than spectacles, and sort of framing the film that way, and also just trying to really give fans of the franchise what they want from a Beverly Hills Cop film, but also making it a little bit unexpected too with this whole emotional angle to the film. Yeah.
Yeah. How did the movie change from the pitch to the final cut? Was there an evolution along the way?
There was a big evolution actually. We worked on, from that first pitch, we worked on the script a lot, you know. We worked on a lot of the comedy and the relationships, a lot of the big set action pieces. Some of them were there, but we worked on some of the action, but we worked a lot on the father-daughter relationship. We also worked a lot on the comedy too. But the bones of the script were there from the very pitch, but definitely a lot of character stuff got worked on. Yeah.
So modern audiences have a different level of awareness of real life police wrongdoing these days than they might have during the 80s. And mm-hmm. It seems like the Kevin Bacon character is meant to represent the kind of rottenness that can come with that position of power. I was wondering what kind of conversations you had with him and even with the screenwriters and stuff like that about that aspect of the story.
Yeah, look, we didn't dive too deeply into trying to have a perspective on policing or anything like that with the film. That's not what Beverly Hills Cop film. It's escapism. Do you know what I mean? That's the type of film that is. So we didn't do that. But I did speak to Kevin a lot about his character, and what I found really interesting was that half the time when I go into Beverly Hills, I'm kind of scared of the people in Beverly Hills. They're kind of like also so perfect and so like sheened and polished and everything like that. And so me and Kevin spoke a lot about that. He had sort of shared these same feelings and us being scared of this like Beverly Hills people. So that affected it. We were sort of looking at Beverly Hills even more so than we're trying to dig into the police aspect of things. Yeah.
It kind of felt like some of the areas in Beverly Hills where you were filming, especially during the big truck chase at the end, that seemed like that was filmed right outside of Victor Maitland's house from the original movie. Like, did you actually go back and look to where that first film shot, or did it just happen?
No, I did. I know where the first film was shot and it was there, but no, we didn't go back to the actual one, but definitely we had echoes of that in our head. You know, we wanted to bring back to that kind of timeless kind of feel of that. Yeah.
How important, I guess, along those same lines, how important was it for you to get the music right in this movie? Because that was such a big part of the experience of watching the original film.
Totally. And like, I got to make my first film, but it gives me Axel F and like, oh, you can use this in your film too. I'm like, wow, okay, this is brilliant. So all along, I had such a love for that soundtrack, for the soundtrack from one and two. I was just like, I get to use these in my film. We were playing it on set as we were shooting. We were playing the Beverly Hills Cop soundtrack because we just kind of knew, like, we're panning. Okay, yeah, let's make it go a little bit faster or whatever. So, and really, worked a lot with Lorne Bolf, our composer, who's did a brilliant job on making this. We wanted to make the soundtrack obviously it's such a big part of it, as it has been in other Beverly Hills Cop films, but also to show that we weren't trying to reinvent it or do anything like that. We wanted to show how much we love the original and that this was our evolution of what had been there in the past. So it was, with all this, a lot of it was just really like a love letter to those first two films a little bit to show, hey, we love what's been in the past. We're going to bring it into a contemporary world, but we want people to know how much we love it. Yeah.
That seems like a challenge that you would have to face in a bunch of different areas when making this movie, in terms of like how much to lean on nostalgia versus how much to bring it forward. Did you have sort of a North Star idea, like a guiding light of how to approach those questions in a bunch of different areas of making this film?
I don't think there's an exact North Star like that when you're doing that, because I think it can be a moving target sometimes. Do you know what I mean? And a lot of that actually, a lot of the nostalgia happens in the edit too. A lot of those decisions are happening in the edit suite too. So Yeah, like we definitely wanted to. I think the interesting thing is that it's been 40 years since Beverly Hills Cop come out. This is not a sequel. It's like this is not one that's coming out 10 years after, like most of them do. Do you know what I mean? Normally, like the sequels come out like a few years. So it's been 40 years. So we wanted to make sure we took people back to that time and place and reminded them of what that film felt like. And what a Beverly Hills Cop film feels like. And so we did use a lot of nostalgia to do that, but also to bring a new audience in and say, hey, this is what a Beverly Hills Cop film is like to them too. And so we definitely leant on it more heavily at the opening of the film too, where we wanted to really place people in Axel's world. This is where Axel's world, this is his safe space, and it is kind of caught in time a little bit. And then when we come to LA, we feel the change, not just in tone, but also in kind of generation a little bit too. Yeah.
Yeah, and speaking of the generation, tell me about incorporating the next generation in the saga in the form of Taylor Page and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Like, when you came on board, did you tweak any of the dynamics those characters had with anyone else, or was it basically always planned to be as we see it in the movie?
Yeah, no, we played it, but we tweaked both those roles a lot. A lot, especially Joseph Gordon-Levitt's role. Just really trying to find the. So it is that buddy cop thing. You know, it's very much trying to find that rub between him and Axel and how that plays off, but also serves the story as a whole, too. And Joe was great. Joe came in with so many ideas on his character and how we can shape his character, and we worked a lot with Joe once he came in to find his angle on the comedy. And what's brilliant about Joe, why I really love him, is he's very funny, but he just plays it in a very different way to Eddie. He plays it very straight, and I think the two of them together, that's one of the things I love most about the film. Yeah,
Yeah.
it's great. Nice. And then Taylor. Always knew the it wasn't about Jane being a comedic it wasn't about putting Axel and his daughter has to be this wisecracking kind of thing. We definitely, you know, the script was built in a way that where she's a lawyer and she's the kind of different character. And so I saw when I first come on, Taylor was who I had in my head from the very start. There's just like a real strength in her eyes and strength of character, and it just was like I want to see her go toe to toe with Eddie Murphy, which is not an easy thing to do, I can tell you.
Yeah. I know the first movie famously, he sort of like came in like a whirlwind and was responsible for so much improv and really helped contribute to that lightness of that tone in that first film. What was the improv process like for you? I mean, being presumably a fan of at least these first two movies, like being on the set and watching Eddie Murphy improv, like how do you decide when to rein him in? How do you know what to do there?
You don't rein him in. That's one thing I learned, that you do not rein Eddie in. Like not every time it's gold, you know, but you know where he's trying to take it or what he's going to do with it, you know. So A was don't rein in. And the big thing, you know, I set out to do was just to create a space for Eddie to do his thing, or for Eddie and Joe to do their thing, you know, like to put the right cast, the right actors across from him. Create room in the writing for that to happen, and create a space on set that where Eddie can work his magic. You know, that's a big part of my job, was to build that environment. And then so much of, you know, this some of the funniest moments in the film is Eddie, you know, just improvising, you know.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I think I'm out of time with you, but thank you so much for your time today.
Hey, thanks for
Congrats
the
on the
chat, Ben. Really
movie.
appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, definitely. I'm excited to see it pop up inevitably as the number one movie on Netflix because I'm sure it will.
Hopefully, hopefully, hopefully. Fingers crossed.
Cool. All
Thanks a
right.
lot,
Well,
Ben.
take
Cheers.
care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right. Any closing thoughts on this movie or any of the other films, Brad? Anything that we didn't touch on here?
No, I'm honest. If there's one thing I'll say, and I'll say this for almost anything that is released straight to streaming, I wish I could have seen this in theaters, because I'll bet it would have been fun to see in theaters with an audience. You know, it
Yeah.
was. It's not one of the funniest action comedies I've ever seen, but it would have been fun to watch with a group of people who are fans of Beverly Hills Cop. And there's some good action sequences here that I think would have looked really cool in theaters. The helicopter sequence in particular, I think, is a really great big screen action action moment, and that, I think it would have worked great in theaters. So yeah, it's a bummer that they didn't even do some kind of, like, you know, limited week run leading up to its release on Netflix, like they do with a lot of prestige pictures that they're trying to get for awards. So yeah, it's a bummer.
Yeah. I'll just say shout out to Ronnie Cox, who played Bogomil in the first couple movies. He's just like such a fun presence. Like, he's supposed to be this sort of stick in the mud authoritarian type of, you know, hard nosed character. But like watching Axel slowly chip away at him and sort of get him on his side is just like really endearing to watch. And the same, I guess, could be said for his relationship with Taggart and Rosewood as well. Yeah. And that dynamic is really like the heart of all of these movies. So I'm glad that they were able to get at least Taggart and Rosewood back into this film. Ronnie Cox died a couple years ago, I think. Yeah, just like on rewatch, I really loved the Bogomil character. Like, not that he's like the most lovable person, but I just love the dynamic between him and Axel and the rest of the gang. So I wanted to say that real quick before we wrap up. All right, I think that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. We're not going to have a podcast tomorrow because of the 4th of July. So stay tuned for hopefully an episode on Friday.
But maybe we should have an episode where it's just sounds of fireworks.
Yeah, maybe one of these years I'll go out and do, be like, what's his name, John Travolta and Blowout or something, and
there you go,
some real live sounds with a boom mic out in the real world. But we'll see how that goes. Don't hold your breath. But you can find much more about Beverly Hills Cop Axel F, including our review of the movie, at slashfilm.com and linked inside the show notes for this episode. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, normally, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That truly helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all hopefully on Friday.